I think most people assume that humans are fundamentally different from the rest of the animal world, that we're exceptional, not just because of our language skills, but also because of our moral values. What do you think?
I think many people believe that we are fundamentally different. Of course, to the biologist, we are animals. So for the biologist, that's hard to believe that we are fundamentally different because we have the same brains. And there's actually no part in the human brain that is not present in a monkey brain. So you would think if humans are that special that there would be some special part in the brain, but it's really not there. So the brains are bigger. And we certainly have, let's say, a more powerful computer than any other animal. But the computer is not fundamentally different.
So it's a matter of difference of degree rather than kind. There's no fundamental divide between humans and, let's say, chimpanzees.
No. If you would ask me what is the big difference, I would say it's probably language. But even it's like with all capacities. If you break them down in pieces, you're going to find some of these pieces in some other species. And that's what I'm doing with morality, obviously, when I talk about the moral comparisons between humans and chimpanzees and bonobos, is that I break it into pieces and I say, well, this piece we can find in chimpanzees and this piece. I'm not sure we find the whole thing, morality as we know it in humans. I'm not sure we're finding that, but we're finding a lot of bits and pieces that I call the building blocks of morality.
Well, you've spent decades studying non-human primates. Can you give me some sense of a chimpanzee's morality?
A chimpanzee's morality, they have a sense of fairness. They are cooperative animals like we are. And if you cooperate, you need to watch what you get out of the cooperation. So if I cooperate with you, and let's say I go hunting with you regularly, and you always take the best pieces of meat and I get very little scraps, that's not a good partnership for me. And so I need to be sensitive to that. And we find that chimpanzees and bonobos are sensitive to fairness. We find that they can be empathic, that they respond to the distress of others by reassuring others and sharing food with them and that kind of things. We do actually experiments on that to see, do they prefer outcomes that benefit only themselves or do they prefer outcomes that benefit both chimpanzees in the experiment?
How do you experiment with that? I mean, how do you do that experiment?
Well, a typical experiment like that is that you put two chimpanzees who normally live together so they know each other. You put them side by side in two rooms which mesh between them so they can see each other and hear each other and smell each other and so on. And then you let one of them choose between two tokens. They get a bucket with two differently colored tokens, let's say blue tokens and red tokens. And if they pick a blue token and they give it to us, they get rewarded for that. If they pick a red token and they give it to us, they get a reward, but also their partner at the same time gets a reward. So the only difference between the tokens is it doesn't make any difference for them because they get rewarded every time they give us a token. The only difference is that does my partner get something, yes or no? And what we find is that over time, they start to prefer the what we call the pro-social token. They start to prefer the token that rewards the two of them. And so we use that as a measure to indicate that chimpanzees do care about the well-being of others.
Which is so interesting because I know a lot of scientists say that the sense of fairness is a distinctly human trait.
Yeah, that's a problem in the social sciences and in philosophy and the humanities. We tend to overestimate the complexity of things. And so, for example, the sense of fairness is then defined as a concept. Some people even say it was invented during the French Revolution or something like that, meaning that only Western humans from a certain recency, they know about it. But of course, the sense of fairness is already present in young children. If you give one child a very big slice of pizza and the other one a very small one, there's going to be a reaction to it. And so that sense of fairness is already very early present, and it's not based on some sort of deeper concept, I think. It's just based on a comparison of what do I get versus what does somebody else get. And so it starts with resentment at getting less than somebody else. And then later you get these more fancy forms where you are not only interested in getting equal amount to somebody else, but you're also interested in fairness in general in your society. And some of these tendencies can be found in the apes. The monkeys usually don't have them. So we make a sharp distinction between apes, which are chimpanzees and bonobos and so on, and humans are basically also apes, and monkeys, which have tails and which are less advanced in that kind of phenomena.
Mm-hmm. We should talk about some specific examples that you write about in your book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, which are fascinating, which get to these questions of the moral instincts of chimps and bonobos. For instance, you write about an old female chimp at your colony at Yerkes, Peony. I'm not sure how you say her name. Mm-hmm. Tell me about her.
Yeah, Penny, she had arthritis. She was very old and had arthritis and could barely move. And so there were cases where we observed that, for example, if she tried to climb into a climbing frame where a bunch of chimps were sitting and grooming each other, she wanted to join them, but she could barely get in there, that younger females would walk up to her and put their hands on her behind and start pushing until she was up there with the rest. So we've seen that kind of things. We've seen cases where she started walking towards a water faucet. It's a very large enclosure, and so the distances are pretty long. And so since she walks with so much difficulty, that we have seen younger females run ahead of her and drink in the water in their own mouth and then walk up back to her and spit it in her mouth. And so she wouldn't need to walk all the way to the faucet, and they would bring her the water.
Wow.
So that kind of things we observe in the group. We observe many acts of kindness. We also, I must add, we also observe many acts of unkindness. So we see both the whole spectrum of behavior, but there are many acts of kindness, and that made us interested in altruistic behavior and testing it out more systematically, because the literature had claimed For 10 years or 15 years, the literature has claimed that only humans care about others, or only humans mm-hmm. are truly altruistic. If primates are ever altruistic, it's only to get favors back, and that's all they do.
Or if it's because they're genetically related, so you know they help their child or their brother, but they wouldn't just help someone else that has no biological relationship.
Yeah, and of course humans are biased in that sense also. We help always more our relatives than non-relatives. And that's true for all animals. No one would argue that if let's say you help a niece because you feel sorry for her or whatever, no one would say that's not truly altruistic. We would still call that altruistic at the psychological level, because you're reacting to a certain situation that she is in. And the same is true for chimpanzees. It's very hard at the psychological level to draw the line between being kind for a niece and being kind for somebody else. But yes, chimpanzees have a lot of cooperation and altruistic behavior going on towards unrelated individuals. And actually in the field, this was tested out, because that was one of the claims that people made, is chimps will only be altruistic if it's a relative. And so the field workers, they started collecting fecal samples on one group of chimpanzees to measure, because in the fecal samples you can measure the DNA of an individual, and so you can know who is related to whom. And if you do that over a sufficient amount of time in the field, you can say, well, all the helping behavior that I've seen, how does it relate to DNA connections between the individuals? And they found that most of the partnerships that they find in the field between chimpanzees, the majority of them is actually non-relatives, individuals who are not related to each other.
So you're talking about empathy here. I mean, the capacity to recognize another chimpanzee's pain or difficulties and then to help that animal.
Yeah, empathy is one of those traits that humans overestimate the complexity of, and that's why if you tell the average psychologist, you say there's empathy in animals, they will say, oh, that's not possible, because they think empathy means that you consciously put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. Now, we know from human research now that that's not the case. In human research, we know there's a lot of empathy, automatic empathy responses, like if I'm frowning and looking sad, you're going to be frowning and looking sad because you're going to be affected by my facial emotions. Or if I'm happy and laughing and smiling, you're going to be laughing and smiling. And so there's a lot of bodily connection in human empathy. And that bodily connection, which is usually called emotional contagion, is easily demonstrable in lots of animals. There's actually now rodent studies on empathy. There's at least a dozen serious studies in Nature and Science on rodent empathy. And so empathy starts with these bodily connections, and they are easily demonstrable in animals. For example, we do research on yawn contagion in chimpanzees. Now, if I yawn, and I yawn enough, you're going to be yawning at some point. And we know from human studies that it's correlated with empathy. People who are very empathic are also people who are very sensitive to the yawns of others. It is very biased. So you're more sensitive to the yawns of someone who's related to you or close to you or a friend than individuals who are more distant. And we tested on chimpanzees. We showed them little videotapes of yawning chimpanzees. And they start yawning when they see that. And they do it actually more if they see it from an individual that they know than an individual that they don't know, just like humans. Mm. And so we test out these bodily connections that exist, and that's how empathy basically starts.
And of course, one thing that scientists have discovered in recent years is that not only do humans have mirror neurons, but so do the apes. And basically, this kind of breaks down that bodily distinction between me and the other being I'm interacting with.
Yeah, the mirror neuron is now often mentioned as a source of empathy. There's quite a bit of controversy about the hyping of mirror neurons that's going on. But yes, mirror neurons are probably involved in this kind of contagion between individuals and being affected by the emotions of others. And the mirror neurons, we should never forget, were discovered not in humans. They were discovered in macaques. Hmm. And actually, the evidence of mirror neurons in macaques is still 10 times stronger than in humans, because in macaques, you can do the physiology that demonstrates them, and in humans, it's very hard to do. And so the evidence is that that sort of the neural substrate of empathy is very much present in other primates.
And explain how this works then. So if, let's say, a chimpanzee is interacting with another chimpanzee, it'll sort of like almost register in its brain what the other one is doing?
Well, we are affected by the bodies of others. And so the mirror neuron, for example, the way that's demonstrated in monkeys is that if a monkey reaches for a peanut with its hand, the mirror neuron may fire. But if a human outside of the cage of the monkey reaches for the same peanut, the mirror neuron may also fire. And so the mirror neuron reacts the same to an observed action as to your own action. And that's why it blends the body of the other with the body of yourself, basically. So the body of the other is going to be represented in the brain of yourself. Now, that's very interesting. That relates to these things that I mentioned, is that if you talk with a sad person with a sad expression, you're going to have a sad expression too. And so mirror neurons are probably involved in that kind of process. And it means that basically the situation of the other blends with your own situation, so that the distress of somebody else, so a chimpanzee who watches another chimpanzee screaming after a fight that he has lost, that chimpanzee is going to be affected by it and is going to be distressed himself by it. And that may explain why chimpanzees console and why we console others who are distressed. And so the empathy is a very interesting phenomenon, because it blends your own situation with the other's situation, and that makes you maybe react to it. It also means, I find that very interesting at a sort of theoretical mm-hmm. level, it means that the difference between selfishness and altruism becomes very vague in the human mind. We like to make that distinction. We like to say this is altruistic and this is selfish. But actually, if you are an empathic animal that reacts very much, that makes the situation of somebody else your own, then that distinction between selfish and altruistic actually sort of becomes very blurry.
Hmm. Now, we should say also that chimpanzees have very complicated social lives. I mean, they live in big groups. There's a lot of jockeying for social status, which is constantly changing among both the males and the females. And there's plenty of competition for food and for mating partners. There's a lot to sort out here, isn't there?
Yeah, that's the interesting part, is that chimpanzees have both sides. They can be very violent and very dominance-oriented, and they defend their territory with lethal aggression. And so chimpanzees can be very nasty, and they can be very cooperative and very friendly. And so what species does that remind you of? That's the question. Because people sometimes say, well, if chimpanzees kill each other, how can you call them empathic? Well, the same argument applies to humans. Humans have that whole spectrum also. And so we can be awfully nice, and I always feel that when humans are altruistic, we are more altruistic than any other species in the world. But we also are probably the nastiest one when it comes to enemies, for example.
Right. And, you know, of course, we wage wars on, mm-hmm. Other groups of people. And so do chimpanzees. I mean, they will, a group of chimpanzees will wage war on a different group in another territory.
Yeah. So chimpanzees, of course, they don't have genocide as far as we know. So that's we humans can be very proud. That's one of our distinguishing features is genocide. And I also compare in my book, of course, I compare us with bonobos. And bonobos are equally close to us as chimpanzees. And are equally relevant, in my opinion. They're more empathic, I think, than chimpanzees.
Well, you call them the politically correct primate.
Yeah, the hippies of the primate world, basically, because they have sex instead of war. And in relation to war, that's what I wanted to mention, is that when bonobo groups meet in the forest, there is some hostility going on, and people have documented that. But very soon, they may overcome that, and they will have sex with their neighbors. And then they start grooming their neighbors, and then the kids between the two groups start to play.
But you'll have to explain this. So they've just met a rival group of bonobos.
Yeah.
You know, there's all this tension there. And then they suddenly start having sex with them?
Yeah, so they start out with yelling and screaming at each other and being intimidating. So there is some level of hostility, but it doesn't translate in chimpanzees. It would translate in a big fight in which someone may lose their life. But that's not what happens in bonobos. It has actually never been documented. That's sort of interesting. In bonobos, in all the years that we have studied them in captivity and in the field, there's not a single case of lethal aggression that has been documented, whereas in chimpanzees we have lots of cases now. Hmm. So that's a fundamental difference between bonobos and chimpanzees.
And one of the other differences is that bonobos are matriarchal. I mean, the females are the dominant ones.
Yeah, the females are collectively dominant. So I would not say that they are individually dominant over the males. They are smaller. They are less muscular. They don't have the big teeth that the males have. But as a collectivity, and bonobos live in an environment where the females can travel together and be together, collectively they dominate the males. And so I find that a very interesting comparison, the contrast between chimps and bonobos on the one hand, and then the comparison with humans.
And just getting back to the sex for a moment, you say in your book that sex is utterly routine among bonobos. I mean, rubbing genitals with another bonobo is kind of like a human blowing his nose.
Yeah, so it's very casual. People always think if you say bonobos have sex or whatever, 20 times a day or whatever it is, people think that it is sex like humans have, which lasts a long period of time. But in bonobos, it's a little greeting of 10 seconds and then it's over. And so they rub their genitals together. They may touch each other's genitals. Sometimes it gets a bit more intensive and more involved. But most of the time, it's a very casual thing. It's like I slap you on the back or something like that.
So the great question here is, which in our evolutionary history are we humans most closely related to? Because as far as we know, I mean, our ancestors broke off from the common ancestor of chimpanzees and bonobos at the same time. We're equally related to both. So is our common ancestor more bonobo-like or more chimpanzee-like?
Yeah, well, that's the big question. And we will maybe never know because the our ancestors didn't fossilize very well because they lived in the forest. And in the forest, everything rots away. And so we don't have actually a good record of our last common ancestor. There's sort of two schools on this. One is the traditional school because we used to know only chimpanzees. Bonobos were barely known like 25 years ago. And so everyone is focused on the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee is violent in their interactions between groups. They have warfare. And so there is a school of anthropologists who believes that you only should look at the chimpanzee and that the bonobo is irrelevant because the chimpanzee fits their thinking about humans being killer apes and being aggressive. And only with time did we become more peaceful. So there are certain books now on that particular topic. And so the bonobo is sort of sidelined and dismissed as irrelevant in that kind of story. And then there's, of course, another group of people who doesn't believe necessarily that we have always waged war and always been aggressive, because the evidence for that actually goes back on only like 12,000 years that we have waged war, which coincides with the agricultural revolution. And so there's another school of thinking that thinks that maybe human warfare is a more recent phenomenon, that we have not always been like that, and that the bonobo is actually highly relevant. And now recently the bonobo genome has come out, and you would hope that that gives us some resolution, but what the genome actually told us, compared with the chimpanzee and the human, is that bonobos are exactly equally close or equally distant from us as the chimpanzee. And so what the genome at least told us is that the two species are exactly equally relevant to the story of human evolution.
So this is a profound question here. I mean, we're really trying to figure out, are humans inherently good with a capacity for evil, or are we inherently evil with a penchant for doing good?
Well, I'm of the school that I think we are inherently good, and we do, under certain circumstances, we do horrible things. And so basically my argument is that this whole resistance to evolution, which comes from fundamental Christians, is partly a resistance to the idea that you could be moral without God. And by embracing evolution, you're basically saying, well, we are an accidental product of evolution, and we don't need God. And that's how people look at it. And the resistance against evolutionary theory comes partly from the fact that people think if we embrace evolution, that's the end of humanity as we know it, because we can basically rape our neighbor and it will be fine.
Well, and we should point out that there are also some very smart Christians who also say that the only way that you can explain morality is through God. I mean, Francis Collins, you know, the geneticist, very prominent scientist, head of the NIH. I mean, he has said that you really can't explain morality through evolution. You need God for that.
I think he must have read the wrong books, because there has been a spate of books, starting with The Selfish Gene, but also Robert Wright and other people. In between 1970 and the year 2000, there was a spate of books that basically told us that evolution cannot explain morality, that basically told us we're born selfish and we don't know where morality comes from. That's what the biologists were telling us. And maybe that's the sort of books that Collins has been reading. If he had read Darwin, because these books are really not Darwinian, if he read Darwin, The Descent of Man, he would have seen that Darwin believed that morality was part of the evolutionary story. And since the year 2000, a lot of research has come out, a lot of new research that has completely changed the picture. We now know, for example, that moral judgments are intuitive. They're not necessarily a product of the reasoning that Immanuel Kant talked about. No, they are sort of intuitive decision-making. We also know that children at a very young age, sometimes before 1 year of age, they already pick the good guy over the bad guy in some sort of puppet show. We know of the primate studies that are these tendencies for fairness and cooperation and empathy. And so the whole story has now changed, and actually people now believe, and the neuroscientists also, that a lot of moral decision-making is rooted in certain evolutionary processes and processes that we share with other primates.
So you're saying that our moral instincts are rooted in our emotions. I mean, this is not something that we reason out. I mean, we can, but sort of at this more basic level, it's, well, as you say, doing good feels good.
Yeah, so we're going back to David Hume, who believed that morality starts with the moral sentiments.
David Hume, who famously said that reason is the slave to our passions.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are very good in post hoc reasoning. Let's say I do something nice for you or I do something bad for you. Afterwards, I will have lots of explanations of why I did that. And we humans are excellent at finding reasons for why we did something. But these reasons are post hoc. Those are not necessarily the reasons that went into the action, which was maybe an impulse that I had at that moment, which I can maybe not even explain to myself. And so we humans are very good at this post hoc reasoning, and I think the philosophers have sort of fallen for that, mistaking these reasons that we come up afterwards with the reasons that we put into our behavior.
So where does religion then come into that? Are you suggesting that religion is basically sort of laid on top of these biological moral tendencies?
Well, religion is very interesting to me, and so the book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, partly because I'm objecting to the new atheists who trash religion as irrelevant and bad and morally wrong and so on. I'm defending religion a little bit against them.
And yet you identify yourself as an atheist.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the word atheist has become associated now with being against religion, and I'm not against religion. So you have an agnostic who doesn't know if God exists. You have an atheist who denies the existence of God. And I may be an apatist or something, someone who I don't care. I really don't care if God exists or not. And if people can lead good lives by believing in God, and if that's their inspiration, that's perfectly fine with me. I don't see any objection to that. As long as they're not overly dogmatic, that's the thing that I object to, is people who have such strong convictions that they want to convince me of them and so on. And the atheists are sort of doing that. Atheists have become dogmatists. Some atheists at least have.
Well, why does that bother you so much, the atheists who really don't like religion and are out to try to smash it?
Well, because religion is so inherently human that I don't know what happens if you kick it out of society. I describe in my book how Sigmund Freud, he wrote a whole book against religion. And at the end he says, well, I'm still not sure what would happen if we would remove it from society. It might not be good if we remove it from society. And he was maybe thinking of the communists who were trying to do that at the time that he lived. And we've seen the communist experiment where they tried to get rid of religion. And actually Stalin killed a lot of religious leaders. That didn't go very well, that experiment. And so religion is so much part of human society because all human societies that we know, they have some sort of belief in the supernatural. And so the question then for me as a biologist is not so much is religion good or bad, but where does it come from? Why do we have it? Why do we have this tendency? Is that good for society? Is that something like a survival skill that we humans have developed, a very special one? And so that's my question. And I do believe that morality came before religion. So religion cannot claim to be the source, I think, of human morality. But religion may contribute to maintaining morality in society.
Well, and one way to put it, I suppose, is once human societies got big enough and you needed to have certain moral rules, then maybe you needed religious credos to establish common ethical guidelines. I mean, essentially, you needed God to manage a larger society.
Yeah, that's the thinking, actually, of some people who study religion and its effect on human affairs, is that when groups became too big, because human groups used to be maybe 100, maybe 200 people, a bit like primate groups. And in these small groups, you can keep an eye on everybody. If you're not very cooperative or if you cheat or lie to everybody, I'm going to pay attention to that and your reputation is going to be damaged. And we have ways of dealing with that in a small society. But if you go to a big society of 1,000 people or several thousand or several million people, then that doesn't work so well anymore. That system of social monitoring in face-to-face societies that breaks down. And so the thinking is that at that point, when we got these larger societies, we needed to have another system of monitoring morality. And what better way than imagining some sort of being who is omniscient, who can see you from any corner, even at night and everything, who keeps an eye on you. And so your reputation is not just in the face of other people, but is now also in the face of this being that we have created that keeps an eye on us. And so that's the thinking why these larger religions evolved and why they may have helped actually sustain these large societies.
You have a fascinating comment at one point in your book. You say you would love to see the atheist perspective on what makes for a good religion.
Why
do you want to see that?
Well, that's partly in response is because Sam Harris, who is one of the neo-atheists, is very strongly against the Islam. And so Islam is the evil religion in his view. And so for me, that raises the issue, well, if one religion is more evil than the rest, then what makes for a good religion? So he must have an opinion about what a good religion is, but I never hear that kind of opinion.
Hmm. Well, just to pursue the religion angle for a moment, there is some question as to whether chimpanzees display certain behaviors that we might consider the precursors to religion. I mean, for instance, people have talked about what's been called the rain dance. Can you describe this?
Yeah, I'm exploring a little bit. I don't think primates have religions, but they have certain things like superstitions. They have maybe a sense of mortality, certainly of the mortality of others, maybe not of themselves. And so I'm exploring this kind of issues. And for example, chimpanzees, they respond to rain, which is very interesting. If you see chimpanzees in captivity or in the field, and there's a sudden thunderstorm that comes through with an enormous amount of noise and rain, the males will get up and put their hair up and start walking around bipedally and sort of dancing kind of fashion. It's called terrain dance, and it has been described in the field for chimpanzees approaching a waterfall where there's also a sudden noise of water coming down. And they then for 15 minutes or so, they, with their hair up, they walk around like that. And this is called terrain dance, and we really don't know why they do it. Are they impressed by what happens? Do they think they can stop it, which would be a superstition, of course? Are they somehow in awe of nature? What is it that makes them do this? And so there are certain of these reactions, also the reaction to death that we see in the primates, where they are very strongly affected by the death of others, and they will not eat for days after one of their group members has died.
So they grieve.
Yeah, you could call it grieving. Certainly occurs between, let's say, mothers who lose their offspring. They it's not only that they don't eat; they scream and they sit in the corner huddled. And so, chimpanzees are very much affected by the death of others, and I think they know it's permanent. And so there's a certain knowledge that they have, but we don't know if they have that knowledge about themselves. Like we humans, of course. It's not only that we are impressed by the death of others, but we know that one day we are going to be dying. And that's an interesting part of probably religion also, because the afterlife plays very heavily in religion. And so I'm looking for that kind of connections.
So the great question is, does a chimpanzee know that it will die, and does it think about that? Does it worry about it?
Well, certainly if a chimpanzee gets older, or if an elephant gets older and cannot keep up with the herd, and a chimpanzee gets older and cannot climb a tree anymore where she needs to go to get her food, you would think that they have some sort of realization of what is going on. But we really don't know, of course.
I want to come back to some of the examples of, I guess, what you would call chimpanzee empathy. And it's more than just empathy. It's how chimpanzees create a community that works. Because I think there's the assumption that that it's very hierarchical, you know, and the alphas rule the roost, and the weak ones, you know, better watch out. But it's actually more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is much more complicated. People always think like the strongest male is the dominant male, and that's how it works. And then when he's not so strong anymore, another male will take over. But I've known groups, and in the field we also know groups, where the smallest male is the alpha male. But if the smallest male is the alpha male, he needs supporters. He needs buddies who support him. And so he needs to groom his supporters and share his food with them and share some females sometimes with them, so he cannot be completely exclusive in his mating rights and so on.
He needs to build political alliances.
Yeah, he needs to bribe them a little bit, and we know actually there was a male in the field in the Mahala Mountains who stayed in power for 12 years, which is absolutely unusual. It's usually more like 4 years or 5 years, and he stayed for such a long time in power. And Nishida, who studied them, a Japanese scientist, he describes in detail how he shared meat with his buddies. So he shared meat selectively with individuals who would support him, and certainly not with individuals who were his rivals. And so he had a whole bribing system built up. And I think chimpanzee society, also in captivity, very often the females have quite a say. So it's not like in the bonobos where the females are dominant over males, but female chimps in captivity, since they're all together there, the females, there's an enormous power block, and no male can get around them. And so if the alpha female doesn't like a certain male, he's in deep trouble, because she's going to support one of his rivals to take over the alpha position. And so it becomes really a political game. And of course, my first book was Chimpanzee Politics, which is all about this coalition building that they do.
Well, and you go even further than that. You say there are cases where an alpha male is attacking, maybe trying to rape a more submissive female, and sometimes other females will band together and protect that female under attack.
Yeah, in captivity, forced copulation by males is basically impossible for males, because the females as a block are opposed to that. And sort of very interesting, because female chimpanzees don't always support each other under all circumstances. They're sometimes rivals also. But when it comes to that particular phenomenon, like a male tries to force himself onto a female, then all of a sudden they're very solidary on that issue, and they will go after the male, and he will regret what he tried to do. Now, in the wild, of course, it's a bit more difficult, because male chimpanzees don't have all these females around. These females are usually spread out over the forest. And so male chimpanzees, the power difference between males and females is actually bigger in the wild than it is in captivity.
And you also say there are cases where two males have been fighting, and then the fight is over, and you know they're kind of licking their wounds. But then the female, there might be a female who comes in and basically pulls those two males together and sort of forces them to make up.
Yeah, I relate that to what I call community concern, is that chimpanzees and bonobos, they seem to have, more than any other animal that I know, they seem to have some understanding of their community as a whole. And they seem to worry about the level of harmony in their group. Now, of course, they have a self-interest in that. Everyone is benefits if the group is harmonious. And so females will, for example, monitor the fights between males. And if these males don't reconcile after the fight, they're going to go over there. It's usually older females who do that, the high-ranking older females. She will go over there and she will start grooming one of these two males who doesn't want to reconcile. And after a few minutes, she will mark to the other and bring the other male with her. And if the male doesn't want to follow, she will take his arm and make him follow. And then she will bring the two males together, and these males are then supposed to groom each other, and they often do.
And aren't sometimes the males still holding a weapon of some sort? And aren't there cases where the female will take that weapon out of their hands?
Yeah, they do. They confiscate weapons. We call it confiscation, and they take the weapons out of their hands. And so the females work on, let's say, good relationships between males, and only females can do that. A male could not be a mediator, because as soon as a male walks into a scene like that, he's going to be perceived as the buddy of one of the two, as a supporter. And so females are much more effective in that. And then the other way that we see community concern is when males break up fights. And so there are certain high-ranking males who take what we call the control role. And as soon as there's a little fight, even the littlest fight between two juveniles, they will go over there and stop that fight. They will break it up. And so they maintain peaceful relationships in the group by stopping all the fight. And they're very impartial in that, is that they don't necessarily support their friends or their mother or something like that. No. And as I said, even the smallest fights that you would think a male shouldn't care about, he will break up. And it's very important that they do, because small fights, like between two juveniles, they often escalate. I hear that at human daycare centers, that's not unusual also. Mm-hmm. They escalate to mothers' fights. Mm-hmm. And so if two kids fight, you have the risk that 10 minutes later two females are fighting. Mm-hmm. And then it gets much bigger. And so it's very important that they nip these things in the bud.
So there's this whole dynamic kind of built into chimpanzee lives to be pro-social. I mean, to basically get along. I mean, that is the dominant ethic, even though there are lots of fights that break out.
Yeah, as I said, they have both sides. They have the tendency of males, for example, to try to dominate other males. That creates trouble. That's by itself a source of a lot of violence and problems in chimpanzee society. But they have these counter mechanisms that make that they can overcome that. They can reconcile afterwards. They have mediations. They also need each other for cooperation. These males, they can fight among themselves, but the next day they may need each other against the neighbor group or to hunt together or something. And so you get that same alternation that we know of human society, where one day we're friends, the next day we have some problem, and then we need to be friends again. And this whole cycle that we go through is very well known in chimpanzee society.
So how do you explain this in the evolutionary sense? Because we have been told for decades that natural selection works through selfishness, through survival of the fittest. The toughest are the ones who are most likely to pass on their genes. That is not exactly the story you're telling here.
That is a simplification, because struggle for existence or struggle for life is very often won, of course, not by struggling and fighting, but by having a better immune system, or having better ears and better eyes. So survival is not necessarily based on defeating somebody else, even though that's sometimes part of it, directly defeating. And so this came actually from Huxley, who is a contemporary of Darwin, who liked to hype the fighting that is going on in the animal kingdom. He didn't know anything about animal behavior. And so he tried to hype that and say, well, the strongest will be the winner of all of that. But actually, that's not how Darwin thought and not how most biologists think. And yes, competition is part of the picture. Obviously, competition is going to be found everywhere, in bonobos and chimps and humans. But there's these very strong counter mechanisms that keep the society together, because the reason we live in groups is because groups are beneficial for us. And so we need to keep our group together. And that is true for so many animals.
One of the things we've been talking about here is, you know, how different humans are, or not different, from the other apes. And I want to put this discussion in a larger context, because there's a long history of trying to identify the specific characteristics that set humans apart from every other animal. For instance, some years back, we were supposedly the only species that not only used tools but made tools. And now we've learned that lots of animals actually make tools, including chimpanzees. What are some of the arguments that have been made for human exceptionalism?
Well, it's a sort of endless argument, is that because as a primatologist, I've lived through all these stages of things that humans, only humans, could do, and then a couple of years later, they were rejected. Theory of mind was one of them. Tool making, tool use, tool making was one of them. Culture was another one. Morality.
You're saying animals have culture?
Well, there's quite a bit of evidence for cultural transmission in the primates and in many other animals, for that matter, where they learn things from each other. And for chimpanzees, for example, one chimpanzee group in the wild versus another one in the wild, they will have very different behavior sometimes, different stone technology, tool technology, social customs, communication signals. And so, yes, we speak of cultural variation in the apes. And so I've gone through all these debates. And usually what happens is that they shift almost every 5 years. And so people will say, will propose something. So, for example, a proposal may be chimpanzees have no imitation. They cannot imitate each other the way humans imitate each other. And then we primatologists, we do a lot of experiments on children, on chimpanzees, and on this and on that. And we show that, yes, actually, they do imitate. They're not bad at it. And the word aping that we have for imitation is not accidental. Hmm. They're actually quite good at imitation. And then people drop that issue, and they move on to the next issue. They say, well, actually, we are the only altruists in the world. And then we do a lot of experiments, and I was very much involved in that. And then we demonstrated that actually chimpanzees are altruistic and empathic and so on. And so we cycle through these claims. And each time a new claim comes along and someone writes a book and says, only humans can do the following things, I know already that 10 years from now it will be forgotten, the claim, because there will be either evidence against it, or people will move on to the next claim that they make.
What about language and symbolic thought?
Language is the only one that you would ever get me to admit as something that is really special. Uh-huh. And so maybe religion also, but religion we don't know much about how that would apply to other animals. But for language, of course, there's quite a bit of research on vocal communication in birds and in primates and language teaching to primates and so on. And for language, I would say there are certain aspects of language that we're going to find in other species. But the whole thing, the whole symbolic communication that we have, I'm not sure that any animal has that. So, for example, it used to be that language was defined by linguists as symbolic communication. Then, of course, this is in the 1950s, 60s, when people started teaching symbolic communication to chimpanzees, they found that chimpanzees can do that. And very quickly, the linguists then shifted their definition to the essence of language is syntax. And syntax is not something that was easily demonstrated, and I think that's still very controversial to say that chimpanzees have any syntax. And so they shifted the definition, and that's usually the story, actually, of the human uniqueness claims, is that they start very broad and they need to become much more narrow in order to be maintained.
Hmm. Now, I've heard the anthropologist Michael Tomasello say that one unique characteristic of human intelligence is that it's collaborative. We're not just empathic and cooperative, as chimpanzees also can be. He says we are the only species that can put our heads together and jointly solve a problem. In other words, we'll stay involved and not shirk our duty.
Hmm. Yeah, that's one of these claims that probably is not going to be maintained for very long. For example, joint action, which is a big part of that, is very highly developed in certain species. Like, for example, orcas. You know, if you go on YouTube, you can find a movie of orcas very highly coordinated swimming up to a ice float to wash off a seal from the ice float. And it's so highly coordinated that you don't know how they do it, how they communicate it. It's certainly joint action of the highest level of coordination that you can imagine. And yes, we are doing experiments also on that kind of coordinations in chimpanzees. And I think that sort of claim will also drop by the wayside at some point.
Hmm. Well, another point that Tomasello makes is, I mean, there's this question of, you know, what's the best way to compare humans and apes? And his argument is that we're better off studying the differences between human and apes because that's how we will best understand both their minds and our own. You don't agree with that, do you?
No, that would not be my approach. It has led to a lot of problems in our field in the sense that if you test children and chimpanzees on a particular standardized test and you find that children can perform a certain thing that chimpanzees cannot perform, you really don't know much. People use that to make the differences clear, but the children are tested by humans, so they're tested by their own species, who talks to them. They sit on the lap of their parents. They are in a familiar environment, and they get familiar questions, and they do very well. And then you get the chimpanzees. They sit in a cage behind bars. They're tested by humans, which is a different species from their own. And they're in a situation that is totally unfamiliar to them and questions. Of course, you can talk to them, but language doesn't do anything for them. And so that you find differences, it's a very unfair comparison, that you find differences between children and chimpanzees under these circumstances is really not so surprising. And recently a study came out of Japan that showed that if chimpanzees are tested by humans, they don't follow the gaze of humans, whereas if they look at chimpanzees, they follow the gaze of chimpanzees. And so all this social testing that is going on chimpanzees that is done by humans, the chimpanzee is handicapped because it doesn't relate so well to us as it does to its own species. And so there's a lot of trouble with these kind of comparisons that people make in order to make the contrasts clear between apes and humans, and I think many of them have a fatal flaw in them.
So why are so many people wedded to the idea that humans are special? Humans are different from the rest of the animal world. What's at stake here?
Well, we were raised with that idea. It's an old Christian idea, is that humans have souls and animals don't. And I sometimes have the idea is that the reason that we have that contrast is because our religions arose in a desert environment in which there were no primates. So you have a desert people who lives with camels and goats and snakes and scorpions. And yes, of course, then you conclude that we are totally different from the rest of the animal kingdom because we don't have primates to compare ourselves with. And then when the first great apes arrived in Western Europe, this was in the early 19th century, they brought great apes to the zoo in London and the zoo in Paris. People were absolutely flabbergasted. They were totally shocked. Queen Victoria even expressed her disgust at seeing these animals. Why would an ape be disgusting other than that that you feel a threat from them? You would never call a giraffe disgusting or something, but the chimpanzee was and the orangutan that they got, she was disgusted by them. And it's because people had no concept that there could be animals, as we call them, that there could be animals who are so similar to us in every possible way. And so we come from a religion that is not used to that kind of comparison, and so it was fairly easy for the Christian religion to maintain the idea that only humans have souls, I believe, because of the distance that we saw with a camel or a scorpion and so on.
And yet a lot of the scientists who still make the case for human exceptionalism are not religious, I would guess. And yet so many scientists cling to that idea that, you know, humans are fundamentally different.
Yeah, those are, of course, mostly not biologists. So the social sciences and the humanities, they're very much still religion-influenced. They they have this whole mindset of humans are absolutely special. I never hear this much from biologists. If you talk with the average biologist, believes that everything is continuous, and we know that DNA sits in a plant and DNA sits in a human. And we see that all as totally connected, and that's also how Darwin saw things. But in the social sciences, yes, that absolute dividing line stays in place, and it's originally a religious idea.
You know, I find your whole take on religion so interesting because you're not religious yourself. Maybe you're an atheist, maybe you're not, but you know, you clearly don't believe in God. But you seem to have, I guess, what I would call kind of a spiritual atheism.
interesting term, yeah.
And you write about the importance of transcendence, the experience of transcendence.
Yeah, actually, I believe that we scientists, the reason that among scientists, you find so many agnostics and atheists, is because we replace religion with something else. We believe, of course, we don't think science is a religion. We don't see science as a religion, absolutely not. But we have a connection to the larger world and the larger universe through our science. Our science permits us to look through a microscope or a telescope or see the larger connections and explore and find new things. And also, so that's one part of the transcendence that we feel. And the other part is that we have a community of like-minded people with whom we correspond every day and read their papers and so on. And so we have this community feeling, which is also so very important to religion.
But I guess my idea of transcendence is it's more than just an understanding of the larger world. There's sort of a deeper, powerful emotional feeling that comes with that.
Yeah, it's an emotional feeling of connection. Of course, every scientist, myself included, we are very unhappy if you say this is mysterious and must be caused by some supernatural force or something. That makes us very unhappy because we don't want to deal with supernatural forces. And so as soon as you find some sort of mystery that we cannot solve, we say, well, how would that work? How could we solve that? And that's our approach, of course, to these larger questions. But still, we feel connected with a larger whole, and that's an emotional connection. I was recently at a meeting where there was an astronomer who basically started crying. He choked up completely when he showed the pictures of stars that were billions of light years away, and he choked up and he couldn't speak. And then after a while, he composed himself and he started explaining that he is still, since childhood, but still now, he's deeply affected by seeing these images. And to me, this brought home, well, he has this he has this connection with the larger whole that all scientists, I believe, feel one way or another, and that for us, that makes it for us less necessary to have a religion because we have that sort of connection.
Well, and I'm wondering if there's something more specific for a primatologist. And you write, for instance, about how often there's a transformative moment the first time someone looks into the eyes of an ape.
Yeah, so for the primatologist, as opposed to Queen Victoria, who was disgusted, most of us are completely fascinated when we look for the first time in the eyes of an ape. And we feel immediately that sort of connection between apes and humans. And this is the thing that fascinates us and keeps us going to a large degree. I was at a meeting of experts on apes where at some point someone asked, instead of a technical question, a more personal question like, why are you people doing this? What keeps you going? Why are you interested in working on apes? And this is sort of the answer that you get from us primatologists. You say, well, we're absolutely fascinated. We feel that connection with humans at some sort of very visceral level, not just a scientific or a DNA level or something, but a very visceral level. We feel that connection. And that's what drives us to do all our work.
Do you consider that, I don't know if you like the word spiritual or not, but does that seem, I don't know, spiritual in some way, that connection with an ape?
Yeah, you may call that spiritual. For me, I don't have any problem with that. I also don't have any problem if you say God is love, then probably I believe in God. And so it depends on how you define things. If you say God is a man with a beard in the sky, I say, well, no, I don't believe in that kind of God. So what you believe in or what your spirituality is about, I think is very much variable among people.
Well, and you write about some remarkable stories of human interactions with primates. For instance, there was an aging female bonobo at the Milwaukee County Zoo named Kitty, who was blind and deaf, and she was protected by an alpha male there. Can you tell that story?
Yes, he was blind, and she would be guided by him. So in zoos, often the apes, of course, they live outdoors in a large enclosure, but indoors it's very complicated with tunnels and doors, and it's very difficult to get around in a building like that. And if you're blind, you will get lost. And so this older male, this high-ranking male, he would take her by the hand, literally, and lead her to the outdoor enclosure. And in the evening, he would take her by the hand and bring her back in. And so this kind of behavior we see among bonobos and chimpanzees, which already indicates a certain amount of perspective taking, and I'm very interested in that particular issue, is do they understand the problems of somebody else?
And then you continue with the story that at one point this male, Lodi, I think the name was.
He attacked. He was being fed by a veterinarian. And he bit in her hand, and he bit off a finger. And this can happen. Apes have such strong jaws, they can do that in a fraction of a second. And so she missed a finger after that. And she came back from the hospital the next day, and she held up her bandaged hand to this male through the window at the zoo enclosure. And as soon as he saw that, he ran to the corner and he huddled in the corner in a sort of fetal position. And then 15 years later, because this veterinarian left the zoo and went to other places, 15 years later, she visited the zoo. And this male was still there, was a male bonobo. He was sitting in an enclosure. He immediately came up to her, and her hand was out of sight because she was standing at some sort of railing. And it was her left hand, and he kept looking. He kept trying to look at that hand and staring at it, but he couldn't see it. And then at some point she held it up, and of course her hand was incomplete. It was a digit missing. And he clearly looked between her hand and her face, and she had this clear impression that after 15 years, he still knew what he had done. Because he had also noticed that when he bit on her finger and broke it off, he was quite a bit affected by it. And so he did something that he probably didn't intend to do. That's what you would think, or immediately regretted. And I've actually observations of bonobos of regret. Is of course, you never know what regret is, but I've seen bonobos bite others and make injuries on others. This is not on humans, but on other bonobos. And within a few minutes, they come back to them, and they immediately grab that one foot or that one hand or that one shoulder where they have put their teeth, and they start cleaning it and licking it. And to me, it always indicates they know exactly what they did. They don't hesitate, like, which hand did I bite? No, they know exactly where they bit and how strongly they bit and so on.
Hmm. Wow. Do you spend a lot of time sort of wondering what it would be like to somehow get inside the head of a bonobo or a chimpanzee?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can get inside their heads. All I can do is observe behavior.
Do you wish you could?
Yeah, of course that would be wonderful, but that's a sort of an impossible question. It's like getting into the head of your cat or your dog. That's not going to happen, obviously. So all we can do is observe behavior and present them with situations where we think we know how humans would react. And sometimes we test humans at the same time. And then compare the responses. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you can't get inside the head of a bonobo or a chimp, but I'm just wondering if, you know, if that's like a big preoccupation for you to somehow try to figure out how to see the world from their perspective.
Well, I think if you... As I do, if you live close enough to your subjects, so I spent an enormous amount of time watching them, In a way, of course, you do get inside their head. You do know, you do predict their reactions. You do know that if this male does that, then this female is going to get very upset with him. And so in a way, you do get into their heads because you know how they're going to respond to things.
What do you see as the biggest mystery out there about chimpanzees and bonobos? I mean, the thing that you would most like to be able to understand?
Well, I think actually that question of spirituality that you asked is sort of interesting. They will not have a religion, but it's sort of interesting to know if they have an interest in supernatural forces or if they assume supernatural forces one way or another. So that's one issue. Another issue that I'm interested in is cultural. I don't think we have fully explored all the cultural variations that we see among bonobos and chimpanzees. We have just started scratching the surface, and we are impressed by what we see, even though many anthropologists don't want to call it culture. Many primatologists feel very strongly that it is related to human culture.
It's interesting because those are two examples, of course, that people would often cite as distinctly human domains, culture and religion.
Yeah, obviously. And morality also. And that's the one that I'm trying to chip away at, is I don't think human morality is a human invention. Human morality has a few special characteristics, but the basic tendencies that underlie it, like being affected by the situation of somebody else and wanting a cooperative society, that kind of values that underlie human morality are not uniquely human.
This has been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was just wonderful.